guys sitting around reciting psalms from the Bible, or what's the thing?
Yeah, you know, who is this Good Friday so good for? Was Jesus up on that cross going, TGIF?
TGIF, okay, yeah.
Well, I've had a week, but this is relaxing. All right, so
I just presumed that when you said you don't want, you know, you want to respect Sunday for Easter, I thought there was something maybe a tiny bit reverent about whatever you're going to do, but no, you're just there drinking.
No, I'm married to a Jewish woman. We just went to a party.
Well, do you and Irishmen ever take part in any kind of Jewish celebrations or anything?
No, not so much.
Really?
We're kind of agnostic.
Well, no, I mean, I don't know. I don't regard the Jewish celebrations as, I mean, apart from the truly reverent ones, like the reading the Torah, but I thought there's a kind of a social thing. It's a tribal, get-together thing. It's about togetherness.
Well, the Christians have the same thing. It's just there's more drinking.
With the Christians is more drinking. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Ed, do you ever celebrate or observe Easter in any way, shape, or form?
I usually go, every once in a while I've gone to Ohio and spent it with my family, but like not, I mean, since my mother died, not really. No, I don't really go there anymore. So.
I'm sorry, when did your mother pass?
She passed away about almost 2 years ago, exactly.
I'm sorry, I didn't know that. I know that she was a big help to you when you were in your illness thing about 10 years ago.
Oh, totally. No, she passed away, she had dementia in the last couple of years. It was really pretty awful, and... the COVID and all this other stuff, she was very,
okay.
Very, very, very hard to see and very hard to communicate with. So it was like, it was a couple of years now.
Well, listen, I'm just curious, Ed. Where in Ohio do you come from exactly?
Well, I don't come from Ohio. My family moved to Ohio. They moved to Columbus in like 2008 or so.
Yeah.
And so my parents were there, my sister is there still, and. I'd go there to see them, and I have friends there now,
okay.
too, so, yeah.
All right, so where did you grow up?
People listening to this a few days later should know that we are recording this on Easter Sunday.
Yes, we are.
And I'm actually at the Wilton Public Library where they're trying to kick me out. Security is on the way, but I'm going to go out to the parking lot.
All right. I went out to an open-air courtyard. And it was delightful, and there was no real interruption, as I recall. So, but I'll be happy to re-record it someday or do another one from the Wilton Public Library. So, Ed, just tell me. The reason I was asking Bill is that I was asking Ed, which we're going to get into this at the end of the podcast, but I want to talk about Bugsy, and I was asking Ed about his. About his fervor about movies before he got into the game that we're in professionally, which was after 2000. And Ed surprisingly told me, no, I wasn't really a movie buff at all. So maybe you could elaborate, Ed. You just didn't...
Yeah, it's really weird. So I liked movies when I was a kid. I definitely remember seeing them like in the 70s and 80s. And I moved to New York in the 87. And I was by 87, I was doing music. I was playing bands and producing bands. And when I moved to New York, I started working in recording studios. And I don't know if you know, but recording studios, it's like a, 15-hour day job normally. So
what did you do exactly in the recording studios?
I was a recording engineer and a producer. So I started out just ground up. Like in England, they call it a tape-off, where you're basically just like an intern.
Okay.
But I moved into like assisting and then engineering and then producing. I was doing that most of the 90s, I'd say. And... took a couple regular jobs along the way, but
is it a studio we'd know?
Well, one of the studios, the last like real recording studio I worked at was called the Magic Shop. That was very famous in the 90s. I mean, Lou Reed did a couple of his last records there. David Bowie did his last two records there before the place closed.
Okay.
So it's pretty
cool. I'm on another podcast called The Accutron Show, which is a shameless plug here, and we do that at the Smash Studios on 38, which is a pretty big place. But, recording studios, for anyone listening who doesn't realize, are kind of dinosaurs now. I do voiceovers, and there used to be hundreds of those, and now there are probably a dozen.
Yeah, very, very, very few. Because yeah, it just, I mean, that's the odd thing is basically after my stint in recording studios, I worked at Sam Ash a little bit in the computer department, and I kind of learned how to do all this stuff on computers, and then I trained all the musicians how to do stuff on computers, and then they were like, "Oh, we don't need you anymore, Ed. We can just do it ourselves at home." And a lot of people I work with do have computers and stuff. But
did you do any movie work at all, like at Todd AO or?
Oh, totally. No, I definitely did you know, recording music. I mean, I recorded music for that Civil War show. Who's the documentary filmmaker? The Civil War, which
Ken Burns.
Yeah, Ken Burns. So I worked with him like way back in, you know. Late '80s, and a couple of movies, not as much movies related stuff, but I mean, we did definitely do like scores. I mean, the first studio I worked at was like a jingle studio, so they did a lot of like jingle type stuff there too. But I mean, the Magic Shop was very pretty heavy duty rock studio, and again, like I said, they Lou Reed was there for a long time, and David Bowie did his last couple records there, and mm-hmm. I'd work with either of them, but still. Yeah, I did some good stuff, though. Yeah.
So when, Ed, let me just ask you, then I'll ask Bill the same question. What got you into the film end of things? How did you get into it? What was your way into it? And how long did it take, once you had established a foothold, how long did it take you before you knew that it was a good idea, that it was a thing that you were doing well, you know, you were in the groove, you felt confident, you know, what was that story for you?
Yeah, well, I started. This is the oddest thing. So there's this, this game called the Hollywood Stock Exchange, which has been around since like the '90s. And I don't know if you know about the Hollywood Stock Exchange, but I was actually watching Donnie and Marie on TV, and they were talking about the Hollywood Stock Exchange. They were saying, "Oh, you could buy stocks and movies, and you know, bonds and actors." It just sounded kind of fun, so I checked it out, and I kind of just got into it really heavily. And this is like in the 2000s. And then because of the game, I was going to see more movies just naturally. And then by, you know, mid-2001, I said, hey, why don't I just write about these movies? And I pitched myself to some website and said, hey, I'll write about the movies. I can write about box office. And I started writing a weekly box office column in 2001.
Uh-huh.
And I just continued to do it. I mean, I ended up going to Coming Soon in 2003. And that was a simple thing of me going to just emailing the guy from Coming Soon and saying, hey, I write these reviews, this column at the site, would you want me to do them for Coming Soon? And I didn't realize how big Coming Soon was. I just knew it was a site I liked. And
When did the Coming Soon thing begin, Ed? What year was that, roughly?
Well, the interesting thing, so Coming Soon, I reached out to him in 2002 just to kind of pitch him. I said, hey, how about a column? I'll call it The Weekend Warrior. Uh-huh. And he goes, sure. And then I kind of like stayed where I was, and then a year later, I made the jump and I went to Coming Soon. So I started Coming Soon April 2003,
uh-huh.
And I was doing the weekly column there pretty much every week. I mean, I had a few, you know, breaks, but I mean, I kept doing weekly pretty much since then at various places. So
Bill,
Jeff, and Ed, there was a guy named Gitesh Pandya, and this is he had box office guru. And yes. It's a good example of how the wild, wild west of entertainment reporting was just sort of what somebody decided they wanted to do. He was the first guy that started tracking seriously, more than Paul Jaborgen or whatever the guy's name was that was the industry spokesman. Gitesh started following how different movies were doing and then started predicting based on some algorithm how much movies were going to make when they opened.
Yeah.
And he was pretty much the only guy doing it for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a question of you found an opening in a market and you just sort of staked your own claim.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I knew Gitesh from when I started doing Hollywood Stock Exchange. I already knew him. I already read his column weekly. I've known Gitesh personally for almost 20 years.
Right, I'm not surprised.
So, I mean, we have a bunch of, like, a lot of people at boxoffice.com I know personally. I mean, a lot of the people I've known for a long time. But yeah, I've kind of just jumped between places doing box office stuff now. I'm doing box office for Gold Derby now for a couple of years now, 2 years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a guy, Tom O'Neill, who basically just was pitching himself to shows like mine when I was on Fox, and he just turned that into something that somebody eventually bought, and that was one of the early sort of places before he sort of gathered all of the A-list critics and put them in on one site.
Right.
He was just a guy reporting on what was going on. And the Gold Derby has gone from just covering, and I am a contributor also to Gold Derby, so I don't want to make this sound like a commercial, but they now cover every kind of contest, from the Grammys to the TV Guide Awards and everything, and it's a cottage industry.
You know, I got to say about the Gold Derby people, whenever they make their Oscar predictions, I always know that not one of them will ever be on their own and saying, well, I don't really go along with the group think on this, because I feel they're always following the wind. They're always putting their damp finger up to the wind and just going with it, with whatever the mood seems to be. They're never
bold. What anybody's doing. Come on. I mean, yeah, that's what you do. That's what I do. That's what anybody does.
Okay.
I think Ann Thompson is notably, she'll only pick things she's seen. So she goes out on a limb pretty early on some things.
I think Ann's rule is on Gold Derby, she won't predict or say this is Oscar worthy unless she's actually seen it, right? Isn't that what her deal is?
Yeah, well, that should be reporting 101 that you've actually, and certainly critic 101 that you've actually seen what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Definitely. But the thing is, the problem is, like, not all of us go to Cannes, and not all of us, you know, even go to Sundance sometimes. So there's a lot of things that people will see at Cannes that the rest of us won't see for months. Like Killers of Flower Moon was a good example of that last year. And it's just the way things are. Some people get to go to some of these bigger festivals and see stuff early, and some don't. So it's a lot of it's like filling in and catching up a lot of time.
I announced a couple of weeks ago that I'm very ambivalent, tipping towards not going to Cannes this year. Partly because it's too fucking expensive, but also because I don't think it's really a place that you need to be in terms of, like, award season films. It's interesting as fuck as far as the European-made stuff. That is great. That I love. And that's where the source of my ambivalence, because I really would like to attend it just on that. But they're not going to show any really hot films this year, including possibly not even the Coppola. Who knows? I have a feeling that that's going to go more likely to Venice and Telluride than to Cannes.
So no one on this podcast right now has yet seen the Coppola film, correct?
I've spoken to two people who were there.
Do you trust those two people?
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
And what was their consensus?
All right, I will, if you'll give me 2 seconds, just two short
seconds. Well, is this something you didn't want to talk about?
I just posted it.
Even though I'm in a car right now driving.
You're driving. Okay, so let me just tell you.
I'm smoking a cigar with the top down and just driving around the Hamptons looking for a better signal.
All right.
But I heard great, I heard mixed, and then I heard it's not going to make 10 cents.
Well, it could be a really good film and still not make 10 cents. It could be both, you know.
Correct.
Here are the two things that I got. And I, one is basically a friend that I've known for about 30 years and in the business. And he says, there will be many and varied responses to this film. Those who love it for its boldness, and that's what everybody says. It's quite out there. It's quite crazy, some people said. And they'll be right, because that's what they feel, and there will be those who dismiss it for reasons that Bill just said, because it's not going to make any money, because it's not addressing the, you know, what most people want to see, not the kind of escapism they want. And perhaps, he said, the film's natural eventual home will be art museums, you know, MoMA, places where, you know, the Lincoln Center, that sort of thing. He says, Megalopolis will require careful and loving handling, which may turn out to be an impossible task in today's market, but here's hoping otherwise. And the second person says, Megalopolis...
Well, that's polite speak for lousy. I'm sorry.
I'm not going to argue because I haven't seen it, but you know, it can be polite speak for it's not exactly a Joe Popcorn movie. And the other observer said to me that Megalopolis is about as non-Joe Popcorn a movie as one can imagine. But it is so startling, so original, and sometimes downright confounding, that there is a certain strata of moviegoers who will see it out of raw curiosity, especially if critics get behind it and there's a major, you know, PR campaign. Her...
So it's more one from the heart than Godfather or even Tucker.
That would be accurate. Yes.
I know that it's basically the storyline of the Fountainhead, and I would love a decent remake of the Fountainhead. That was one of my favorite movies when I was a kid because I just thought it was so rebellious. And whether you like Ayn Rand or not, I thought, the rebel architect, which I guess is what Adam Driver is doing here, is fertile ground. I mean, I think that could be great.
Yeah. Well, there's supposed to be a lot of naked women in it, according to one of the observers.
Okay, well, now there's a bonus.
And there's also a... Anyway, that's the thing. And I suspect, because I don't, a lot of publicists, a lot of marketers, a lot of people who work for the distributors, they feel that basically it's cannons of, it will kill you if you get the wrong kind of response, whereas it's friendlier, or it can be seen as friendlier if it goes to Telluride, and Venice is also tough, but not as tough.
What's funny about everything you've said is it sounds like an ideal Cannes movie.
Because there will be people that will love it and hate it, but it'll be a very passionate thing. Yeah, maybe. Who knows? You know,
it'll still get a 10-minute standing ovation. I mean, my concern is that Coppola has become the new Terrence Malick or Stanley Kubrick in that he can talk anybody famous into being in his movies, but and they don't really know what they're in until they go to the screening and see it.
Yeah. Anyway, here's one rundown from a friend over at Awards Daily about what he believes the Best Picture predictions will be. And I did the exact same thing about two, three weeks ago. And basically it's, Jesus fucking Christ. I was looking at last year's. All right, now I got to move it down. Sorry. I got it. Okay. Number one, he says, is going to be Conclave, the Focus Features film, which is about a pope that has died. And it's about intrigue and some dark buried secret. And Ralph Fiennes is the star. And I don't know how, that sounds more like a Focus Features also ran. And a good one, but doesn't sound like a real winner to me. But you tell me. you guys know about Horizon, of course, which is the Kevin Costner film called Horizon: An American Saga. That's Warner Brothers. I've argued already that I feel it's basically the same movie, even though they are going to screen it in two different time periods, once in June and the second one in August. I don't think it's any different than, say, showing Lawrence of Arabia with a 15-minute intermission in 1962, because it's basically two halves of the same movie. And that's all they're going to be doing here. Everybody says you're full of shit, and that is not valid, and people are going to have to pay to see it twice, so it's two separate movies, and what do you guys think about that idea?
Well, that was, remember the last thing in my memory that would be like that was Mannion of the Spring, and what was the other half of that? That was, and people were literally mad when the first one ended, and they found out there was a Liv Ullmann movie that did the same thing. What was that? The Norwegian thing that was in two pieces, and that everyone was slightly annoyed by because... it ended, and you were like, oh, now we have to go to we have to wait 3 months or whatever for the next one to come. And we live in an ADD world. I mean, I don't know that that's going to wash. What it means is a lot of people will probably wait for both versions to what I, and it sounds like Yellowstone, the movie. Well, a lot of people will wait for both of them to be streamable and watch them then.
Just blow it off theatrically? Okay.
I was saying, the thing is, Bill, we just had Dune, where literally it ended a cliffhanger. Not everyone knew that that was a part one when they went to see it. I mean, I was kind of not 100% sure. And they waited 2 or 3 years for the next one, and it did okay. I mean, I think...
No, you make a good point, although the Dune 2 sort of stands on... They're both confounding, and they don't require each other, except that they're the same world, the way the Star Wars movies are the same world, and you don't have to see all of them at once, but it's still, I think, a challenge for younger audiences. That's all I'm saying.
No, it's possible. But I think, Kevin Costner is not really, like, making movies for younger audiences, though, so it's not like Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if he's gonna make a big jump into, like, you know, making movies for like teens and 20-somethings at this point.
I think he's seen. It's a bad thing, as you guys know, to be a white person, and even worse thing to be an older white person. And it's another bad thing to be a movie about white settlers moving across the Great West and dealing with Native Americans and all the troubles that came with that. So that's three things against this movie right at the top. From the wokesters, I mean, because they don't like they'll love a thing about Native Americans, but if it's a white person movie in covered wagons, that's a problem right out of the gate.
Yeah, well, Civil War is having the same problem, I think, right now in terms of...
Really? Why?
Well, I'm getting that sense. I haven't seen it, but I mean, I'm getting the sense that it's brutal and it's a tough sit, and it has to be woke or it's just going to get pounded otherwise. And you know, we've talked on this podcast about how I say the things that want to be politically incorrect nowadays have to be historical.
Uh-huh.
Then they get a pass.
Uh-huh.
And I all of that said, I still think if Civil War is brutal on and favors in any way what the North was trying to do to the South, we're going to have a conversation about it, and it's going
to
be loud.
What was the North trying to do to the South? Out of curiosity.
Well, I don't know what this movie's take is going to be on that.
It's about the reds versus blues, but it doesn't use Trump as a figurehead.
Right, but you got to deal straight, as you like to say, you got to deal straight cards. You got to, I hope that it's not trying to be politically correct about the Civil War, because that's not a thing that we should be that proud of, right? I mean, if it doesn't show it as a difficult time for America, then it's just trying to play to a modern audience.
Well, as painful as the Civil War, Ed can tell us that because he worked on the PBS Ken Burns thing, and the Civil War. Oh, not to digress too much, but we were basically a collection of regions and states. And after the Civil War, after we went through all that agony and pain and bloodshed, we were really the United States of America. It was a defining event as far as this country was concerned, as agonizing.
But I mean, look at how we've had to re-edit and apologize for Gone with the Wind. Even I mean, it's I don't know. I'm really interested to see that. And then again, I don't mean to dump on you because it's your business. But the idea that we can pick anything Oscar-worthy at the beginning of any year is kind of ludicrous.
No, it's not. It's obviously going to be, the big primary color movies, they're not going to go, or they never nominate films that have any kind of subtlety or softness or quietness about them. It's got to be vivid. You know, like, for instance, Steve...
Well, we didn't know shit about Oppenheimer or...
That's vivid. That's the atomic bomb. How can you call that soft and... oblique. It's
no,
obviously.
No. What I'm saying is, this time last year, we didn't know about Oppenheimer or the holdovers. But what I'm saying is that most of the stuff that's legitimately Oscar worthy comes out at the end of the year anyway.
Yeah.
So we can look at a production schedule and a release schedule and kind of try and draw some tarot cards out of the deck. But we don't really know anything yet.
I knew exactly what was happening as far as Alexander Payne's film is concerned. It was shown at the. During the Toronto Film Festival of 22, I think it was, and Focus bought it, and they said they're going to bring it out in 23, but not until the fall. That was a pretty clear thing. Everybody knew about that. And also, Oppenheimer was, you know, they discussed that ad infinitum when it was being made and before it was being made and the whole thing. I remember getting into a whole dispute or argument, why aren't they going to show the obvious result of Oppenheimer's astonishing invention, which was the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They didn't show it. And that was a thing. That
well, ironically, since we're having this conversation, there was a piece I sent you in the Wall Street Journal this weekend about how well, even though it just got released there, mm-hmm. that Oppenheimer is doing in Japan.
Yeah, that's interesting. But they were all the distributors there, were afraid to release it. Right?
Right.
Except for some art house distributor that picked it up and they finally went with it.
Yeah, they did pretty well, too. It's, I mean, it's like, I think...
They what?
1.7 million. It did pretty well. It did, like, I think, 2.7 million in IMAX.
Okay.
I think it was only IMAX in Japan. Right. I'm not sure. But it did pretty well. But going back to Cannes for a second, I mean, the thing is that, I mean, well, there's two things about this. I haven't been able to talk on any of these subjects yet, but Cannes, I mean, last year they had Anatomy of a Fall and Zone of Interest, and those are the first time those two movies started getting seen and getting awards. And I think even then, I first saw them at Toronto, and I was kind of not impressed because there was so much hype out of Cannes already that I was already kind of like, eh. I already had the kind of like a.
You weren't that impressed with what? With after the both of those films
and
or what?
Either one.
Uh huh.
Either Anatomy of a Fall. I saw Anatomy of a Fall and I Zone of Interest back to back on the first day of Toronto last year.
Yeah.
And they both had won a lot of awards out of Cannes, a lot of raves. I mean, I think a lot of people were already talking about awards at that time too, but. Seeing them with that kind of, when you have some can and people rave about something, it's almost as bad as people trashing something. Because when you rave about something and then you have to wait 3 or 4 months to see it, it builds up this anticipation. And so the people who see it next festivals are going to be a little jaded, a little cynical about it because they have to be shown that it was as good as everyone said it can.
So then, Ed, it begs the question as to whether you warmed to either of those movies as the year wore on and you saw more things. And then when the end of the year came along and they were nominated, did you think, maybe I need to revisit these or I still feel the same way?
Yeah, I did want to revisit both of them, and I just never got around to doing either one, even though I had screeners for both. But I was kind of interested. I saw the value and the merit of them when I saw them. I mean, you see Anatomy of a Fall, and you cannot deny her amazing performance. You cannot deny the script. You cannot deny the editing. They were there. It's all there. And even the stuff for Zone of Interest. I mean, I was surprised they didn't get a score nomination because all those crafts were there. You know, you could all the quality is there. It's just that whether or not you see it as like, well, as good as Oppenheimer, because I saw it. Obviously, I saw both of them after I've seen Oppenheimer already.
Did you come out of both of those thinking that Sandra Hüller was like a major talent that was going to have to be watched?
More so for Anatomy of a Fall. I was not as impressed by her in Zone of Interest as others were. I mean, she's great. I mean, she's great to watch. But I don't think it's really a role. And it's sort of, you know, the difference between the roles. But yeah, definitely. I'm really curious to see what she does next. I mean, it's like it's hard for European actors to really kind of break out. You know, obviously we've seen, you know, even Vivian Rose, what's the name of this actress who won the Oscar for
Cold Yard.
She's found some places like with, we worked with Christopher Nolan, but she's not had a very easy time getting more, you know, roles in Hollywood, mm-hmm. you know, versus European films. So it's like, it's still very tough for European actors, even if they win Oscars, to really just keep maintaining. Right. The thing is, for Sandra Hüller, I mean, she'll be known for Anatomy of a Fall, but she'll have to be in something really, really big in the States to really cross over.
I thought she did.
You know, Juliette Binoche is a great example of that. Someone who won for The English Patient and then didn't really, I mean, I can't think of anything that pops besides this year's The Taste of Things. But to your point, I think you're right. And I think that Hollywood identifies American actors that they think will sell tickets and gets behind good and bad ones. And I know we're going to get to Sydney and her work, but in this podcast, I'm sure.
Sydney Sweeney? What about her? What are you talking about?
Well, I just think that she is somebody that Hollywood thinks is going to be a big star, and they're going to keep putting her in stuff that until... And all I want to say about how you've dumped on her, which is fine, is that if she's a one-note actress, you have to admit that she was great, pretty good in Reality, but great in Euphoria. And if that's all she can do, then that's all she can do. But she's good in a very vertical category.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna defend Sydney Sweeney right now because I think she's an okay actress. I don't know if she's like that great, but I mean, I think as someone who's literally, you know, where she's been an actor for a long, long time now, for decades almost, and the fact that she's producing movies that are very successful. Not anyone but you. You can throw it off as a rom-com, but it made money. It made a lot of money for Sony.
Yeah.
And then also...
And that was a piece of shit.
Well, yeah,
it was. It was terrible. I hated it. I couldn't stand it. I left about 2/3 of the way in. I figured I'm just pick up on the story later on from somebody who's seen it, but I couldn't stand it. I thought the writing was awful.
It's the kind of movie that's kind of movie that a lot of American and even European audience want. They want something kind of just light and they can just go and have fun. And then I like her better as a comedic actress. I think she really threw herself into it, and I didn't hate that movie. I had a good time with it, and Immaculate is another example. Immaculate, I mean, she found this project, produced the movie, and she basically got it made. And it's right now it's one of Neon's bigger hits, other than Parasite. It's going to do very well so far, and
What speaks of the time and of her performance again? It was the trip to Bountiful for me, I guess, this weekend's Wall Street Journal. But she did a Q&A in that, and she said that her work for Immaculate, she did her research on TikTok looking at nun videos. That's a verbatim quote, and I thought, boy, that's just the time we live in. The modern day Meryl Streep, and I know you're going to argue with that, but someone who's aspiring to be a great actress is looking at TikTok videos of nuns to see what she should do with her performance.
Yeah.
The only thing I'll say in her defense that I thought was really cool.